Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Gail Seiler, and I'm here with my co-host, Greta Anderson. Hello, Greta.
Hello, Gail, and hello to you, the listener.
Great to be here. It's lovely fall weather out there.
Yeah, I think are we in fall yet?
It feels like it, and I'm glad.
It's September 21st. I think that's right around the...
Oh, yeah, that is the official start. I didn't realize that. Great.
Well, yeah, good. Beautiful weekend.
Good. And some of our listeners may have been paying attention to football over the weekend, some ups and downs for Iowa State football. ISU lost to the University of Toledo, so that brings their record down to 1-2. And do you know how Iowa did?
I understand they defeated the University of Pittsburgh, so Iowa's record is now 3-0.
Ooh, that's tough for Cyclones to take. But
and my team, the OSU Buckeyes, lost, which is surprising.
Oh, so, yeah. Who did they lose to?
I don't know. My mom just told me they lost, so, you know, I took her word for it.
Yeah, and they were expected to keep winning.
Yeah.
So that's a big shock. Well, today we're not going to be covering sports in the show, but we're going to be covering several important themes that have been in the news a lot lately. In the second half of today's show, our focus will be on immigration. We'll be talking with Hector Salamanca from the American Friends Service Committee and the organization called Governing Under the Influence. He'll be talking about immigration issues in Iowa and also about an event that will take place this Wednesday evening in Des Moines called Immigration, Detention, and the Iowa Caucuses. And we will also hear a segment on someone from Ames who has built one of those tiny houses you may have heard about.
But first, we'll be talking with Dr. Ann Clifford, who is in the studio with us. Dr. Clifford is in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at ISU, where she is the Monsignor James A. Supple Chair of Catholic Studies. Thank you for being here, Dr. Clifford.
And thank you for asking me.
Last Tuesday, Dr. Clifford gave a lecture at ISU that was called The Encyclical of Pope Francis on Ecology. And with any luck, KHOI will be airing that lecture this Thursday at noon and 7 p.m. for our Heart of Iowa show. Dr. Clifford spoke about the Pope's encyclical on ecology and what we might expect to hear from the Pope during his visit to the United States, which begins tomorrow, Tuesday. So my first question for you, I'd like to hear a little bit about your talk before we talk about the upcoming visit. And can you tell us what an encyclical is?
Oh, certainly. An encyclical is an official letter from the Pope meant for the entire church. Originally, it was just for bishops, but since the 1960s and Pope John the 23rd, they've been meant or directed towards all people of goodwill.
Okay. And how often do encyclicals come out?
That is up to the Pope, but usually they address a pressing problem. And in this case, it's the concern about the environment and care for the subtitle of the encyclical, which is Laudato Si, is care for our common home.
Care for our common home. And so you spoke about the ecological concerns that Pope Francis brought up in the encyclical. We hear a lot about climate change, but there was more than just that to it.
The Pope certainly gave a great deal of attention to climate change. He dealt extensively, really, in the encyclical with climate change science, having himself two degrees in chemistry. He has a scientifically oriented mind. But he also talked about a new concept for Catholic teaching called integral ecology, which takes into consideration the human family and that human beings are creatures who are deeply related to nature and should not be looking upon ourselves as a part or as dominators of it.
That's quite a change from Catholic theology as it's developed over the centuries, really.
Yes and no. There's been a movement more in this direction since the 1970s when there was awareness brought to the whole population of the planet, practically speaking, on problems with the environment.
Okay. And in a way, he's living up to his chosen name.
Exactly, because the title for his encyclical, Laudato Si, is Praise Be, the first words of a very famous prayer of Francis of Assisi called the Canticle of Creation, in which the words, our care for our common home, actually appear. If I could just say one little more thing about this, because sure. It's so beautiful, especially for me as a woman, talks about our common home is like a sister with whom we share our life and a beautiful mother who opens her arms to embrace us. And this sister, our Mother Earth, is now crying out for healing and help from us.
So the highlight of the Pope's visit to New York it is the United Nations General Assembly on Wednesday, where it will deliberate about the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And that ties right in to the Pope's concern about our common home.
Most definitely it does. Here again, I think he will emphasize when he's there the piece on integral ecology. Again, humans are part of nature, and we are faced with, as according to him, and I think he's absolutely right, two separate crises, one environmental and the other social, and both of them need to be addressed together and not as if they are completely separate. I would suspect that while he's there, he's going to be highlighting some of the Sustainable Development Goals. Last April, he had an opportunity to be in conversation with Ban Ki-moon at a conference hosted by the Vatican on the environment. And I think he will probably especially address at least three, possibly a fourth goal. I would presume he's going to talk about the first goal, which is to end poverty in all its forms everywhere. That was a goal also for the millennial goals of, 2000. Also, I think goal 13 stands out for me as one that he will certainly address, and that is we need to take urgent action to combat climate change and its impact on all of nature. The 17th goal is also very important and significant. Revitalize the global partnership for sustainable development and ecology. And I would also think that number 16 would be significant. Promote just, peaceful, and inclusive societies.
In describing these goals, you've kind of touched on what my next question was, which is that the partnering of social and environmental concerns. And can you say more about this?
Well, I think the partnering in a way is, I think the Pope's concern is the state of the environment now and how if we continue on the path, it's only going to get worse. And also the outcomes of climate change have huge economic as well as just basic human outcomes that are negative. For example, he speaks very harshly in that encyclical. And here again is a quote, if you don't mind me giving it, because his words are better than mine. We may well be leaving to coming generations debris, desolation, and filth. One of his primary questions is, what kind of world do we want to live for the children who are now, little ones today? He also says the pace of consumption, waste, and environmental change has so stretched the planet's capacity that our contemporary lifestyle is unsustainable and is going to end up resulting in catastrophes. And certainly that has been supported since the 1990s by James Hansen's research. He's from the NASA group who talked repeatedly to Congress about the outcomes. And certainly the scenario is bleak unless we do something now.
So he's talking to the first world as well about reducing its consumption.
Right.
Well, I've become something of a Pope watcher since Francis has become Pope. His views on ecology, of course, have been very interesting, but other things that he's been involved with and news that he's made has also caught my attention and certainly generated a lot of excitement on the internet and so forth. His solidarity, for instance, with people who are in desperate situations, the solidarity with people in prison, for instance.
Right.
I remember hearing that around Easter time he was washing the feet of people who were in a detention facility.
Exactly. He continued a pattern that he adopted when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires. And it's on Holy Thursday, normally a bishop will wash the feet of certain priests, and there'll be, you know, a special Catholic ceremonies, which I don't need to get into here. And that same would be true in Rome. But what he did on Holy Thursday, April 2nd, 2015, is that he went to Rome's Rabibbia prison, the prison in which the person who tried to assassinate Pope John Paul II back in 1981 was housed. And he washed the feet of 12 inmates, including not only Italian prisoners, but also men and women, notice men and women, from Nigeria, the Congo, and Ecuador, at least one of whom reported that he was a Muslim. So this was a very unusual deed, and certainly, I think, a memorable one.
And wonderful symbolism in so many ways for what the message he wants to get out. For those of you just joining us, this is Local Talk, and we're talking with Ann Clifford, Dr. Ann Clifford, the Monsignor James Suppel Chair of Catholic Studies at Iowa State, and we're talking about the upcoming visit of Pope Francis to the United States. The Pope will be in New York for Wednesday's UN meeting, and we've been talking about that and what we can expect the rest of the week.
Yeah, so can you tell us some of the events along the lines that we've discussed, unusual gestures by the Pope to bring attention and awareness to those who are suffering in our midst?
Yes. One of the things that the Pope has added to his United Nations visit is a visit to Our Lady Queen of Angels School in Harlem on Friday. I think this is another expression of his solidarity with people living in poverty. And during the World Youth Festival in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil back in summer 2013, he also did something like this. He altered the original schedule planned for Pope Benedict and decided to visit one of Rio de Janeiro's poorest slums called Vergina, a crowded shanty town inhabited by the poorest of Brazil's poor and a place of troubled violence. And there he walked the streets and embraced the children and talked to them at a soccer field and really was among the people.
Wow. So he'll be in Harlem, known to be a poor section of Manhattan.
Yeah.
And I read that he's also going to be visiting a correctional facility.
Yes, as I mentioned, yes.
Yeah. And well, tell us more about the Pope's work in Latin America before he became Pope, his work in Buenos Aires.
It's rather unusual for a Jesuit to accept or be even asked to have a position such as archbishop. So while he was there, rather than to live in the, shall we say, palatial home, next to the cathedral church, he chose to live in a slum with the folk and commute to work on public transportation every day. He took a subway and a bus to get where he needed to be. And I think this is certainly rather extraordinary for most bishops anywhere.
Yes, it certainly is. And so now he's kind of visiting the belly of the beast in terms of economic inequality, mm-hmm. coming to the richest nation on the world, the one that where a country, the United States, that has been often accused of worshiping wealth. And
right.
So how do you think he'll handle that?
Well, I was reflecting on this in the light of not just this encyclical, but his previous apostolic exhortation, The Joy of the Gospel. And there he called for on rich people to share their wealth. And here again is a little quote. Just as the commandment, thou shalt not kill, sets a clear limit in order to safeguard the value of human life, today we have also to say, thou shalt not in an economy of exclusion and equality, because such an economy kills. We can only use so many things of the planet. Why can't we share what we really absolutely don't need with others?
Mm. So It seems that he is really talking about issues that other popes obviously have not spoken about and not many politicians speak about, although they perhaps should. But do you think – is he making more of a intentional purpose to speak not just to Catholics but to speak to everyone? Is he doing more – is that like in his mind more, do you think, in terms of his purpose than other popes?
Most definitely. I think that he's – you know, he's trying to be – to have sort of like a language that is common to a whole variety of people – not just in the sense Catholics speak. He's really trying to extend much beyond that, and both in his words but also in the symbolism of the things he chooses to do.
Right. Yes, most definitely.
I mean, when migrant workers were landing in Italy, or rather immigrants, please excuse me, from the Middle East, he went right there to encourage acceptance of them early on when it was just starting to, you know, become more apparent that the people were going to be seeking any place they could and whatever little vessel they could find to get to Europe. And so he went there, you know, way last year just to encourage welcoming people.
And he's spoken out about the Syrian refugee crisis as well.
Yes, yes. That every country, and even so far as if you have room in your home, you should try to be welcoming persons who have struggled so much just to be free.
You told me there were a few refugees living in Vatican City?
Oh, yes, there are. And the Pope has tried to extend to them as well, yes.
Well, many people think of the Catholic Church. They think of the Catholics, the Church's view on the family. And I wanted to explore that with you. We just recently, Pope Francis made annulment an easier process for couples to get. He also made a statement a couple years ago, I think, that, you know, if someone is gay and searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge?
Correct.
So it seemed like he might be more accepting. Yet he's also spoken out against gay marriage and gay adoption. So where do his views on the family kind of fit into his?
This is a more difficult thing for me to answer with simple clarity, because as we approach the Synod of the Family, it's hard to know because the Pope cannot make these decisions only on his own. And he has called very strongly for decentralization of the Vatican. He wants much more participation, including of women. He has appointed women to certain positions that women never had before, including his special counsel to assist him with, you know, making decisions. So it's a little bit difficult for me to answer that. I think while he's in Philadelphia at that big Independence Mall, I'm not sure that he's going to be making controversial proclamations, especially since just in October the Synod of Bishops will be meeting about issues. But he often goes off script, as he did in Cuba just recently. So it's really hard to say. But I don't want to try to put words in the Pope's mouth.
Okay.
I might hold a little chair, you know, of Catholic studies, but it is indeed, in a sense, little.
Can you say just a little more about how he went off script in Cuba?
I just happened to hear it on your station this morning as I was, you know, getting ready. So they said that he had some kind of prepared remark he was supposed to make, but I didn't catch the full thing. I guess I wasn't quite awake yet.
Yeah. I read that he had spoken out against ideology. Which makes sense. Well, anything else that you'd like to say about this?
Well, I think that there's, you know, some things are, you know, going to be very large and very sensational, especially in Philadelphia, you know, as I said, at Independence Mall. And when he gets there, he's going to be coming at the end of what is known as the Family Film Festival. And that is a festival that's sort of entertainment, you know. films such as The Mighty Max, the story of the NCAA champion Immaculata College women's basketball team will be featured, and The Diary of a City Priest, a priest who's reached out to people in North Philadelphia who are exceedingly poor, will be featured. Shall we say it's not like at a very high level, perhaps? I hope I'm not insulting anybody from Philadelphia, but so that will be part of it. And then right after that, he will be becoming involved in a World Meeting of Families, which is a movement that Pope John Paul II started in 1994. They meet every 3 years. I think this is the first time they will be meeting here in the United States. And the theme there is love is our mission, the family fully alive. So that's a pretty open-ended topic for the Pope to enter into. But I think that I'm just anticipating, but I don't know for sure. I doubt that there will be that many specifics about the issues that you raised, that because it's just the setting is not right for that, I think.
Does the Pope have press conferences?
You know, I don't really know. There are press releases, but he seems to just – people just follow him around. The press is with him all the time. I guess he really wouldn't need to have a specific conference because they're always there.
Mm-hmm.
There are sometimes where there's official announcements that he makes, such as that he was coming to the United States. So I haven't really been thinking in those mm-hmm. terms. Yeah.
This is KHOY, and you are – well, thank you, Dr. Ann Clifford, for being with us today.
Yeah, you've given us a lot of things to be listening for and looking for when we follow the coverage of the Pope's visit. Thank you.
Again, thank you for inviting me.
This is KHOY, and you're listening to Local Talk with Gail Seiler and Greta Anderson. And the Pope's arrival tomorrow is really big news.
Yes, and much about the Pope is big, his hat, his ring. But as our guest mentioned, his dwelling is rather humble. I don't think it's quite as humble, however, as that of our next guest.
41-year-old Ames resident Nathan Thrailkill has been conducting an experiment these recent years. His studio apartment is no larger than 150 square feet, but he has tinier ambitions than that. They are focused on a 6-foot by 14-foot cabin on wheels that has been taking shape in his backyard.
I've been kind of downsizing my stuff for years, but recently I moved into a super small apartment just to try it out, to see if I could live in small spaces, if it would be claustrophobic, and kind of just doing it step by step. So checking out this cabin, seeing how it feels, and whether, you know, like, say, a tiny house would be comfortable to live in. That's part of the experiment right now.
A few things you should know about Nathan. He works as an educational assistant at Northwood Preschool, and he's always wanted to build.
I had an interest in architecture. Well, I have had an interest ever since I was a kid. But I decided not to pursue it because the kind of architecture I was interested in was not really being offered at the university level. It's still pretty rare. I've helped build an earthship. I have volunteered on a straw bale home build. And I even got to build an earthship hut from ground up. So that's the kind of architecture I'm interested in. With this cabin, I just wanted to experiment with building something small enough and light enough that could be mobile and yet look more like a home than a mobile home or a camper. I've been a resident of Ames for about 11 years now, so I kind of consider this home now. It hasn't been 11 years straight. I've moved away, come back, but I always come back to Ames, it seems like. I'm a part of the Ames Bicycle Coalition. I actually bike everywhere. I use my bike for just about everything. Groceries, going to work, commuting, just about everything.
And in fact, it's a good thing Nathan Thrailkill does not own a car.
I've been at the mercy of the weather because I'm building outdoors. I also happen to be building this cabin in my parking space behind my apartment. which my landlord has been just extremely gracious. And actually, he's been excited about this project. I was really hesitant to bring up this idea, but it's just, it's been a project I've been wanting to do for so long. And I thought I have to try it. So I proposed the idea to my landlord. He went along with it, and he's actually been ecstatic. He's really enjoyed seeing it come along. So here it is in the backyard.
Did you build the frame from the ground up, or what were your starting materials?
This was a former pop-up camper. And actually, if you look to your right, you can see just some remnants of it. I kept a little memento of the aluminum siding from it, but I wasn't sure what I was going to do with the camper. I wanted to use some parts, but I eventually ended up just completely demolishing it, tearing it down and starting from ground zero. So basically, I had the trailer frame, the flat frame, and I just built everything from ground up. And this was a totally new experience for me. Weight has been an issue. This is a single axle trailer. A lot of the tiny houses you see online, they're double, even triple axle, and they're really heavy. They're really huge. This one it's relatively small compared to the other ones. So I've tried to cut weight wherever I can. In the framing, I've used smaller studs, 2x3s, 2x2s. Other materials, I've just tried cutting weight. I've tried using lighter weight materials, the paneling. You know, the furnishings are even pretty minimalist. There's not a lot of mass to it. So, yeah, just trying to design solutions that incorporate lightweight. Behind me is ladder shelves, I think they're called. This is fairly new to me, but I saw this project in a book. And basically, as you can see, it uses the floor and the wall for support. So there's not a lot of extra weight in plywood, you know, sides, bottom, top. What else? We have a marine heater. This is a fireplace that's meant for boats. And it's compact and small enough and lightweight enough that you can mount it right on the wall. It burns wood and it'll heat a space this size. So I'm looking forward to using that when it starts to get cooler out.
Just for the audience, it's about maybe 16 inches tall by 8 inches deep, 8 inches wide, and you were saying that it would just burn one little piece of wood at a time.
Yeah, it's just kind of cute. It burns wood, and it'll still give you that nice feeling of a wood-burning stove, but it just takes pieces probably about the size of my index finger or thumb. And he put a few of those in there, and I guess people have been using them on their boats for, you know, forever.
So, of course, everyone will want to know, what are you going to do when this little spaceship is done? Where are you going to take it? What are your plans?
Yeah, that's one of the most common questions I get. Since this is an experiment, I hadn't really thought too far beyond where I would take it or what I would do with it. Eventually, I would probably like a more long-term home for it. Since I am renting right now, this space is temporary. So we'll see. We'll see if there's a nice little plot of land that it would just be cozy sitting on, or I have no idea what the future holds.
Do you think it'll be able to be transported by bike?
I've been asked that. There are these promo photos for old Airstream trailers. And, you know, one of the things they build them as was being super lightweight and aerodynamic. So there's a promo photo showing a guy hauling one on a bicycle. I think it's actually for real. They didn't have Photoshop back then. But this cannot be hauled by bike. This was probably about, I'm guessing, 3,000 pounds. So pickup.
And is this just a recreational vehicle, or is this potentially a permanent home for you?
Well, for the Ames City officials out there and any concerned neighbors or community members, this is just temporary recreational. By law, I'm only supposed to recreate in this vehicle, but it is considered a vehicle, so it is legal here. It's considered an RV. As to whether I could live in here, that's part of the experiment. It's been really easy to downsize. It's funny how once you start paring down stuff, you find stuff that you never even used, and you think you needed it, and you think you wanted it, but you haven't used it in years, and it turns out you really didn't need it. Lots of stuff I've gotten rid of. And it's been a slow process over the years, too.
And the issue of claustrophobia, how does that work for you?
Yeah, I found myself you know, looking for stuff to do outside more and getting out in the community more, which, you know, that might be a good healthy side effect.
You mentioned it's legal. It hadn't crossed my mind that it might not be legal. I guess there's no waste disposal system. You have a sink of sorts, but where does the waste go and so forth?
Yep. That's my introduction to permaculture systems. So some future projects will be, and this probably won't happen in the city of Ames because I believe gray water systems are not legal currently. But I do have a sink, and that's for just gravity-fed water. So well within the legal bounds, I can bring in water from my apartment, have it gravity-fed into my sink, have it for my cooking, for drinking. And I have what's called the all-purpose bucket. And that's for emergencies of any sort. But you're right, there's no plumbing in here. There's no electricity. The future solar panels will power LED lights, super efficient, and my little cube-sized dorm refrigerator. And it's actually a thermoelectric cooler, I believe. So it doesn't have all the noisy components of a refrigerator. Oh, and it'll probably have, you know, enough power to power up something like my laptop. So far, all my neighbors love it. Actually, I had one neighbor who was really interested in it, and she was asking all kinds of detailed questions. She loved the color. She wanted to know about materials and cost. And at the end of the conversation, she was like, so do you plan on keeping this here? And I was like, well, no, this is just a rental. This is just temporary. And she's like, oh, good. Then it'll be moving soon.
It is kind of interesting. Some of the typical housing and zoning regulations do not accommodate tiny house ambitions.
Right.
Do you know whether in other towns or cities there are accommodations for tiny homes?
I think there are a lot of groups trying to advocate for tiny houses and tiny house communities. But yeah, pretty much I think the general rule is most states have a 300 or maybe it's a 600 square foot minimum. So you actually cannot build a house smaller than that. It's an interesting code. You know, I'm not opposed to codes. I know they're, you know, they have a purpose and sometimes they're beneficial, but that one really confuses me, why you can't build as small as you would like.
Interesting. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this tiny house and where you might go with it?
Well, I can't wait to actually get it finished. I'm maybe 90% done, but I look forward to getting the fireplace installed. I look forward to the solar panels. And when I do, I can finally have an open house, because I've had neighbors and friends asking me about it, and they're really interested, and I can't wait to have people come over and see it, probably one at a time, because it's it's probably got a capacity of about two or three people.
Well, it's very cute, very homey.
Thanks. Glad you like it. Glad you could come over and hang out and have a cup of tea with me.
And that was Nathan Thrailkill of Ames, Iowa, building a 6-foot by 14-foot cabin on wheels in his parking space behind his tiny apartment.
I'm not looking for money, not looking for fame. I don't wear designer suits with some idiot's name. I'm not staring at the ground, waiting for good times. When my day is done, I'm a man of small ambition. I'm a man of small ambition. I don't.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio in Story City, Ames. The song we just heard was Small Ambitions.
That was an interesting combination of the song and the tiny house story. Our attention now turns to a topic that's also been in the news a lot lately, immigration. And we've been joined in the studio by Hector Salamanca. Thanks for being here, Hector.
Thank you for having me, Gail.
Great to see you. And you're with the American Friends Service Committee and also collaborating with an organization called Governing Under the Influence. Can you tell us about those organizations and how they are working together?
Yes. So I'm actually the grassroots engagement coordinator for Governing Under the Influence. Governing Under the Influence is a project of American Friends Service Committee. So I also work for American Friends Service Committee. Governing Under the Influence traces its roots back to New Hampshire, where my colleague Arnie Alpert came up with this idea to follow the presidential candidates and ask them questions regarding American Friends Service Committee issues around war and peace.
Okay, so you're actually a project within the American Friends Service Committee.
Correct.
Okay. And you're having an event this week, so why don't we start with that and you can tell us about this event.
Yes. So we're having an event called Immigration Detention and Iowa Caucus in Des Moines at 7 o'clock on Wednesday at Trinity Las Americas, United Methodist Church. And our event focuses on a little-known law that's in effect called the Immigrant Detention Bed Quota. It's a mandate passed through our Congress that allows private corporations to build these facilities, rent them out to the government, and it requires the government, ICE, specifically Immigrant Customs Enforcement, to detain 34,000 immigrants per day in these facilities created by these corporations. These corporations helped lobby to get this law passed through Congress, which really shows how corporations are influencing our political system.
So when was this passed?
This was passed early, I believe, a couple years back during the Bush administration.
Okay.
And this lobbying really has impacted the immigrant debate because these corporations are able to lobby our politicians. They've been able to donate money to certain campaigns, to some presidential campaigns. And we're talking about thousands of dollars that is having a clear impact. There's a report called the Grassroots Leadership Initiative. They have a report stating that these corporations have stated in their assessments to their stockbrokers that if immigrant
reform, shareholders?
The shareholders, uh-huh. If immigrant reform were to happen, it would hurt their bottom dollar.
Okay. So you're saying that the corporations lobbied Congress, mm-hmm. both the Senate and the House, passed this, I guess it was a legislation or a policy.
Yes.
That actually set a quota and mandated that quota be filled in terms of numbers of undocumented immigrants that should be detained. Is that a description of what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay. And so what Governing Under the Influence then is trying to do around that issue, but more broadly, is make people realize the role that corporate money and lobbying has in influencing policy in the U.S.
Exactly.
Okay. Could you say a little more about that, or why you think that's so important?
I think that's so important because we're experiencing the presidential election in a way we've never seen before, specifically for myself. I'm a younger individual, and this is the first time I'm seeing corporations really play a role with the donations impacting policies. We've been, as part of GUI, we've been attending both Democratic and Republican events, trying to ask questions to these candidates surrounding corporations influencing not just the immigrant detention quota, but also other issues revolving around AFSC themes of war and peace. So we've been going to these presidential candidate events and asking them questions about police militarization, the military-industrial complex, the immigrant detention, issues that are very important to those who are eligible to vote and very important to those here in the United States who want to make sure that corporations aren't driving our federal policies.
Okay. And so let's get back. Just tell us a little more about the event. How is the event going to be structured? Who's going to be there on Wednesday night?
So on Wednesday night, we are bringing in colleagues from Denver, Gabrielle Flora. She is the immigrant service director in Denver, and she specializes in detention centers because in Colorado, they actually have a detention center there. We're also bringing our colleagues from New Hampshire, Arnie Alpert, Eric Saluska, and Olivia Zink. They are my counterparts in New Hampshire, and they've been bird-dogging as well presidential candidates and going to their events with our banners. And we'll also be bringing some staff from Philadelphia to just bring everyone together and refocus GUI. At the event, both Gabriela and Sandra Sanchez, our Immigrant Voice Program Director here at AFSC in Des Moines, will be speaking about the detention bed quota. And we're also going to structure it in a manner in which we're trying to get individuals to join us to bird dog and ask these presidential candidates. And if they're not able to do so, then to join us to do banners outside of these events.
Okay. And can you explain to the listener what bird dogging is?
Yep. So bird dogging is a term that we coined to simplify going and asking presidential candidates questions. It's a catchy term. It shows how, as a bird-dogging individual, you're determined to ask the presidential candidate a question, and you want to follow up with them, and you're not going to simply take no for an answer. The way AFSC has structured DUI, we go to events, we go to events where they're free, so we don't have to pay and contribute to a campaign, mm-hmm. and we attend. We do trainings where we show our potential bird-dogging individuals how to interact with presidential candidates, what time to show up at an event, how to best raise your hand. We have these tips where you have to make sure you raise your hand the first time. You have to make sure you stick your hand out if the candidate's walking. Make sure your question is concise and clear, and you really know what you're asking. And most of our trainings, they've gone very successful, and people do enjoy being able to determine what exactly they want to ask and cut away some of the layers that they add on to a question because they've never done this before in a manner in which AFSC has trained them to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I attended the training session you had at the library here in Ames earlier in the summer, and it was interesting. I learned a lot of things.
Yeah, it sounds like good training for a journalist in many ways.
Yes. It's true because you're trying to do the same thing, mm-hmm. get your question answered. So it's really important to get people to think about what their questions are. So how do you see Iowa and the Iowa caucuses playing a role in bringing these kinds of issues to the fore?
So the great thing about Iowa is that a lot of presidential candidates come to Iowa, and the way their events are structured is very open to the public. They take a lot of questions for the most part. It's very rare for a town hall event to happen where the candidate just speaks and takes very little questions. And even if that does occur, there are instances where the candidate will step away from the stage and shake hands with people. And in that point, you can get a question out. For myself and for those who have come with me to these events, we've been able to ask Senator Ted Cruz a question in that manner where he was just walking down the line at an event he had at Drake University, and I was able to ask him a question. Rand Paul in Des Moines, after his office opening, I had a volunteer with me, Noma. She was a student at Grinnell. She was able to ask him about the detention bed quota, and he actually turned to her and said, "Walk with me," as she's asking him this question. So it's been very beneficial being here in Iowa and interacting with these candidates in such a personal level, because we wouldn't be able to do that in any other state other than New Hampshire, of mm-hmm. course.
Yeah, so that's why you're focusing on those two mm-hmm. Early caucus and primary states.
Yep.
Interesting. Interesting strategy. So are there particular immigration issues here in Iowa that you're trying to bring attention to as well?
Yeah, so largely my program solely focuses on a very specific part of the immigration issue. Just because if we try to cover everything, it'd be mm-hmm. You could dedicate more staff to just immigration in general. For myself, this is also a personal issue. I am technically undocumented. I have a deferred action for childhood arrival, and it's been a long and personal journey to grow up in the United States. And right now, to have this job and being able to interact with candidates, it is somewhat an interesting mm-hmm. scenario because of the rhetoric used by some of the candidates, and it puts me in a difficult situation where I want to address it, but I have to address it in a manner that fits into my capacity as well as what I can handle as well.
Okay. So you're here under the – and you're able to work and so on mm-hmm. under what's called DACA, Deferred
Correct.
Action for Childhood Arrivals.
Correct.
Just to remind our listener what that is. Okay.
Well, you mentioned the rhetoric surrounding that many of the candidates have been using, and I know that Donald Trump is claiming credit for the immigration issue being even debated. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you would disagree with him. That's your issue. But we had quite a scuffle here last weekend with the ISU
mm-hmm. at the tailgate.
University mm-hmm. of Iowa tailgate with a group of students who were protesting mm-hmm. the rhetoric used by the politicians. And I was there to witness that, and it was really remarkable the kind of emotion mm-hmm. that is generated around this issue. And I'm just wondering, how much of that emotion is manufactured mm-hmm. by the pundits and by the candidates, and how much is based in reality? Do you have any idea?
I would say it is impacted by the conversation that's going on by those who are in power and those who have a way to express their ideas. The way I've handled is that I really want to focus on the issues and get the presidential candidates to address the issues. And for me, on the side, on top of my job, I also want the Latino vote to come out and to vote, to caucus, and pass that, to get involved in politics, to run for office. And if these students make that transition, that'd be incredibly wonderful, because protesting, it's one step forward, but voting, two steps forward, and then becoming an elected official, it's, you know, you're taking leaps and bounds at that time. So I want to make sure that we capitalize as a community from these events and make sure that, you know, we're bird dogging and we're going out to these events and asking presidential candidates questions, because Trump, being to so many events, he's not the only candidate that's shared these views, whether it be focused on immigrant detention or just immigration in general. He's not the only one that focuses on these issues. And I really want to see other individuals, Latinos, young college students, get involved and ask every presidential candidate issues that they care about, whether it be AFSC issues, GUI issues, or their own personal issues. It's important that we be out there as a young population out there asking these presidential candidates questions. And a lot of people, you know, they're somewhat apathetic because they think their voice doesn't matter, but their voice does matter. If you're out there getting involved, engaging with the presidential candidates, asking them questions, you're going to change policy. With GUI, we've successfully been able to, hopefully, we can claim credit for this, we've been able to get Hillary Clinton to address the detention bed quota. We've been able to get Senator Bernie Sanders to address it. Martin O'Malley, he was ahead of us in that regard. He was able to address the issue. So we've been out there and we're seeing the concrete changes that our impact, our what we're doing is having, an impact that we're having. Senator Bernie Sanders in Muscatine, Iowa, I was invited to a roundtable and I was able to ask him about the detention bed quota. And this was a week ago before he introduced his legislation this week calling for an end to for-profit prisons and the detention bed quota. So whether or not we had an impact, I can't really gauge, but I like to believe that we helped contribute to him addressing that issue.
That's really interesting that by raising these issues with the candidates, you're actually bringing them to everyone's attention, including the candidates, and kind of forcing them to take a position on it. Yeah. So from your interactions with the candidates that you've seen so far, you've mentioned a few. There are some that seem to be a bit more knowledgeable of the issues around corporate influence, particularly on immigration policy. Some that seem to be a bit more knowledgeable and more I don't know what you would say, progressive in thinking about how these might be changed. So which would you say are more aware?
I would say a lot of the candidates, quite frankly, since I started, they have very little knowledge about this issue, just because it's not something that's brought up in the larger immigrant debate and just the larger conversation about issues in this election cycle. And most of the candidates would comment to us that, I'm sorry, I don't know enough about this issue.
They would actually say that.
They would actually say that, and they'd ask us to provide information to them or their aides. So I followed up with not just Democratic candidates, but also Republican candidates. We've been able to ask Bobby Jindal the same question, Senator Ted Cruz, Governor Jeb Bush. We've been able to ask almost all the presidential candidates this exact same question, and their responses have almost all been similar to, I'm sorry, but I don't know enough about this issue. So us being able to present the issue to the candidates is raising their knowledge of it and raising awareness of the issue. And we've had conversations. A memorable one was with Senator Ted Cruz, where we asked him this question, and he actually called for an end to corporations, you know, being involved in our election cycle, which for me was, wow, you know, this is something you wouldn't get from just, you know, listening to the media. So it does change. That personal interaction with a candidate does change. And once again, since we're in Iowa, it calls for you to get involved, essentially. Like, there's so many opportunities for you to meet these candidates, and it'd be your loss not to go out there and engage with them.
Yeah, it sounds like it's really having an impact. That's kudos to you.
Thank you.
Can I ask for a couple of details? Are there names of these corporations that are involved in the detention facilities? And, you know, what kind of numbers are we talking about? How many people are being detained in those facilities?
So currently, one of the two biggest corporations is GEO and CCA. They're for-profit prisons.
GEO and CCA.
CCA, yep. And they, sadly, I don't have the statistics with me, but they are contributing a heavy amount to the presidential candidates. One of the two has contributed greatly to presidential candidate Marco Rubio's campaign. And that has, if you see his changes on immigration, I believe it has impacted his policies. We've been able to ask him that question about immigrant detention to him two times now. The first time was in Ames while he was having an event. And I asked him that question, and he did not appear too happy to be taking that question because I called attention to him. And, you know, he disagreed with my opinion, and that was that. And with me that day, I actually had a volunteer. And Mark Rubio's, I think one of his last events in August, he was able to come back, and we were in Ankeny, and he was having a, you know, family get-together, a picnic, not something that you think he was going to get bird-dogged at. And this volunteer that was with me from the original Ames event came with me, and we actually gave him a report, the report that I earlier referenced, the grassroots leadership report, about immigrant detention and how corporations are influencing this immigrant debate. We gave it to him. You know, she talked to him in Spanish, which was very personal because he replied back. And he mentioned how he knows people in immigrant detention centers. But at the end of the day, the law has to be followed, the rule of law. So for us, it was interesting to see a presidential candidate be handed hard evidence and for him to still remark that, you know, the law has to be followed. And in this regard, it's not that the law is not being followed. It's that corporations are influencing our political system where they're able to get such a peculiar mandate to pass through Congress and then have, you know, the audacity to report to their stockholders or shareholders that if immigration reform were to happen, it would hurt their bottom dollar. So it's, you know, it's eye-opening for me to be able to engage in this conversation and provide these candidates hard information because it's hard to get away from it. It really is.
Yeah, it's kind of a sick cyclical phenomenon that's happening with the corporations and capturing, pulling people into it and really influencing their lives in very profound and negative ways. So it's great that you're doing this work, and we appreciate you coming in this morning to tell us about it. And just repeat one more time the event on Wednesday, the name and location and details on that.
So the event on Wednesday is the Immigration Detention Centers and the Iowa Caucus. And it's at Trinity Las Americas in Des Moines, Iowa at 7 o'clock. And we're hoping to have a lot of people turn out for a great conversation about immigrant detention mandate and how you can get involved in what we're doing, going to events, bird-dogging candidates, and, you know, putting banners up and raising awareness about our issues and trying to change the political narrative.
Great. Thank you very much for being here. And we'll put a link to that up on our website when we post the show later today so people can get more information that way. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. Thank you for joining us today. I've been your host, Gail Seiler, with my co-host, Greta Anderson. Thanks to our in-studio guests, Ann Clifford, a professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at ISU, who helped us understand things to listen for in the Pope's upcoming visit to the U.S.
And just a reminder, we hope to broadcast her lecture that was held last week about the Pope's encyclical on ecology this Thursday at noon and 7 p.m. on our Heart of Iowa show.
And thanks also to Hector Salamanca from the American Friends Service Committee and Governing Under the Influence. He told us about an event that will take place this Wednesday evening in Des Moines called Immigration Detention and the Iowa Caucuses. And we'll have a link for that on our website later today.
Thanks also to Nathan Thrailkill for inviting me into his tiny home and agreeing to be interviewed. And I think we'll be using a photo of the interior of his house for the show on our website.
So people can see it.
Yeah. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's entire Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will find information about the people you heard today, along with contact information and links to the people, places, and things we talked about. In fact, our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. That song you heard, Small Ambitions, is by Robert Morey and the Hired Guns. And Jonah DeGeest was our engineer for the day.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, which means you can be part of our team of volunteer reporters. We'll train you and you will learn and love more about our community than you ever dreamed of. We certainly do. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or through the website khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as an audience is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.